Iran says it's ready to build two power plants in Lebanon and help rebuild Beirut's port that was destroyed by a massive blast last year. Moscow says NATO's expulsion of eight members of the Russian mission to the military alliance will have an adverse effect on their ties. And according to a UN report, the Security Council sanctions against North Korea have worsened the country's humanitarian situation. Hi everybody from Tehran, I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The Iranian foreign minister says that his country is ready to help Lebanon overcome its economic crisis. In a news conference in Beirut, Hossein Amin Abdullahian said that Tehran is ready to build two power plants in Lebanon and help rebuild the Beirut port that was destroyed in a huge explosion last year. He was speaking after talks with top Lebanese officials, including President Michel Aoun and Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri. In his meeting with President Aoun, Iranian foreign minister stressed Tehran's support for Lebanon's independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity. President Aoun also said that Lebanon supports efforts aimed at creating convergence among regional states. Our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Salah, says the Lebanese officials have welcomed the expansion of ties with Iran, particularly as regards resolving fuel and electricity shortages in that country.
The Iranian foreign minister also stressed once more Iran's readiness to assist Lebanon in all issues, and the fact that the initiative or the proposal to build two power stations, which could give around 1,000 megawatts a day, something that Lebanon is in dire need of, and no other side or no other country has presented that such a proposal that could be done with the Lebanese government paying in the local currency, which would be very much helpful because it would be built based on work that would be done in Lebanon, so therefore it would be done through Lebanese currency, which would be very significant for the country, would not have to bring in more U.S. dollars, would not affect the current crisis, would actually help uplift the current situation. Now we see with Lebanon with the power cuts that are basically paralyzing the entire country, and despite the fact that we do have Iranian fuel coming in, assisting the general or private motors, and of course some institutions and charity organizations and hospitals and so on, still we do have a major crisis when it comes to providing electricity for the entire country.
From Beirut, I'm now joined by Jamal Wakim, Professor of International Relations with the Lebanese University. Good to have you with us, Professor Wakim. So let's hear your opinion regarding Iran-Lebanon ties, in particular this latest Iranian offer to embark on some development project to help Lebanese.
Well, I think that the Iranian proposal is a serious one, and I believe that Iran could help on the economic level, especially that its economic offers are not bound politically the way the Western offers are for Lebanon. However, I don't see a big chance for these proposals to be accepted by the Lebanese government, because too bad, the Lebanese government is much influenced by the West. Its members, most of its members, except for Hezbollah members, are affiliated with the West and are representatives of Western capital. So that's why I believe that they would do their best in order to hinder these proposals and not accept them. And they have done the same with other proposals coming from Russia and even from China. So too bad. If these proposals are to be accepted, I believe that our only chance is that they pass through Hezbollah.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Jamal Wakim, Professor of International Relations at Lebanese University in Beirut. Now, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has released footage showing Iranian Navy vessels tracking a U.S. warship. The footage displays several IRGC speedboats chasing a U.S. warship in Iran's southern waters. The Islamic Republic has repeatedly warned against any active aggression, pledging to defend its territorial integrity on the country's borders. In 2016, IRGC vessels seized two U.S. command boats after they entered Iran's territorial waters. The Yemeni army says it's downed a spy drone belonging to the Saudi-led military coalition over the Jizan region. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said that the Yemeni air defenses shot down a U.S.-made aircraft while it was carrying out hostile missions in that area. The general said that the footage of the wreckage will be broadcast soon. Saudi Arabia launched a war on Yemen in March 2015. It's killed tens of thousands of civilians and displaced and millions of others. Palestinians have denounced an Israeli court decision to grant Jewish worshippers the right to perform prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry says it will exert all efforts to challenge the decision. The Hamas resistance movement also decried the ruling, calling it a blatant aggression against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem said the ruling is another attempt to divide the holy site that's in violation of all international law and norms. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement has also slammed the decision as invalid. On Wednesday, an Israeli judge in the occupied Al-Quds ruled that Israelis' silent prayers at the Al-Aqsa could not be considered as a criminal act.
On Wednesday, Israeli judge ruled that silent prayer of the Israeli Jews at the compound of the Al-Aqsa Mosque cannot be considered a ruled act and is now allowed. This comes because there was an appeal by Israeli Jewish rabbi Ari Aleppo against Israeli police ban that were not allowing him to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and to pray there. We have to make it clear that Israeli settlers raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound frequently. However, they are not allowed to pray there because the compound houses the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Clashes continue to take place. Of course, Palestinians are demanding international position because allowing the Israeli settlers to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound is illegal. However, now while allowing the settlers to pray there, then Palestinians are in need for action, not only condemnations from the international community or the European Union. Palestinians are hoping that the EU and the international community would be forcing the Israeli regime not to allow this new policy to take place.
Russia says NATO's latest actions against it will have an adverse effect on the alliance's ties with Moscow.
There is a glaring discrepancy between NATO officials' statements about their wish to normalize relations with our country and real actions. These actions, of course, leave no room for illusions regarding the normalization of relations and the resumption of the dialogue with NATO. These prospects are rather completely upset.
The Kremlin spokesman made a comment today after NATO expelled eight Russian diplomats, accusing them of being undeclared intelligence officers. The alliance also halved the size of the Russian mission, accusing Moscow of increased malign activities against NATO members. Russia has repeatedly denied such allegations made by the Western alliance. Reacting to NATO's latest moves, a senior Russian lawmaker said that Moscow will retaliate, but not necessarily in kind. Based on a UN report, the Security Council's sanctions against North Korea have worsened the country's humanitarian situation.
Sanctions imposed by the UN Security Council should be reviewed and eased when necessary to both facilitate humanitarian and life-saving assistance and to enable the promotion to the right to an adequate standard of living of ordinary citizens.
The UN rights investigator says the risk of starvation threatens the country's access to food has become a serious concern. Yet the impact of sanctions has also left the country short of essential medical supplies while increasing prices by several fold. In June, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said that the food situation was tense because of natural disasters, acknowledging that his people faced difficulties during the pandemic. The European Union says it will use all options if Britain goes on with its plans to undo post-Brexit trading arrangements for Northern Ireland.
UK decides to go for launching Article 16 or simply disapplying the protocol, then you would understand, and I can assure you that we will not hesitate to use all options available to us to safeguard the EU interest.
Maroš Šefčovič told a conference in Dublin that Brussels would bring new proposals for the Northern Ireland Protocol next week. He expressed hope the move would pave the way for talks with the UK. He also urged London to drop the, quote, political rhetoric in the row. London has threatened to suspend the Northern Ireland Protocol if the European Commission refuses to renegotiate the document. The provision has created massive problems for the region by imposing checks on transit of goods with EU member Ireland. The UK has so far voluntarily kept the checks suspended. Now, when it comes to social media giant Facebook and its offshoots, there are many arguments for and against as to how they are being operated and benefited. A Facebook whistleblower, however, has come forward and heavily criticized it. While testifying on Capitol Hill, she accused Facebook of harming children, sowing division, and undermining democracy in pursuit of breakneck growth and astronomical profits.
U.S. social media giant has come under scathing attack by a former employee. The company has been accused of putting profit over everything else. Former Facebook employee Frances Hogan says that the company's sites and apps are harmful for children. She's also accused the social media platform of stoking divisions in society. 37-year-old Hogan was previously a product manager at the company. Now she's a whistleblower and has turned against Facebook. She made the accusation at a hearing in the Senate. Hogan accused Facebook of putting profit over safety and compared it to tobacco companies, arguing that a company with such frightening influence over so many people, over their deepest thoughts, feelings, and behavior, needs real oversight. She also said that if left alone, Facebook will continue to make choices that go against the common good.
If you look at the way that they filter content, if you look at the way that they censor certain topics that they'd rather not be seen, the way that they quote-unquote fact-check some of the things, the way that they delete accounts without discretion, the way that they censor people, and the way that they choose what content goes at the top of your newsfeed or shows up on your newsfeed at all through their algorithm, they really have a grip on what it is we are able to see on Facebook.
The context for the hearing were materials that she had leaked to the Wall Street Journal. According to the documents, Facebook's own studies suggest that Instagram and social media in general have a negative psychological effect on young girls. She also accused Facebook's CEO Zuckerberg of having too much power and bringing up the January 6th Capitol riot.
Facebook wants you to believe that the problems we're talking about are unsolvable. They want you to believe in false choices. They want you to believe that you must choose between a Facebook full of divisive and extreme content or losing one of the most important values our country was founded upon, free speech. That you must choose between public oversight of Facebook's choices and your personal privacy. That to be able to share fun photos of your kids with old friends, you must also be inundated with anger-driven virality. They want you to believe that this is just part of the deal.
Now, according to the whistleblower's testimony, Facebook consistently chose to maximize its growth rather than implement safeguards on its platforms, citing more division, more harm, more lies, more threats, and more combat. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, however, hit back, saying that her claims are illogical and simply not true.
Facebook has faced growing scrutiny and increasing calls for its regulation. Founder Mark Zuckerberg hit back, saying the latest accusations were at odds with the company's goals. In a letter to the staff, he said that many of the claims were illogical and pointed to Facebook's efforts to fight harmful content. The CEO argued that while Facebook took the initiative to create a massive research project to identify and solve certain problems, critics are merely weaponizing that work against the company to create a false narrative. Responding to Hogan's claims that Facebook's attempts to limit harmful content were constantly hampered by a shortage of staff, he said, "If we did not care about fighting harmful content, then why would we employ so many more people dedicated to this than any other company in our space, even ones larger than us?" Facebook is the world's most popular social media site. The company says it has 2.7 billion monthly active users.
So I think overall it's very detrimental to democracy because of the flow of information that is so tightly controlled through Facebook. And I also think it shows, much like tobacco companies in the past or vape companies, that they've targeted children who are in very crucial developmental stages in their lives in order to get new customers, as noted in the testimony before the Senate.
Hundreds of millions of people also use the company's other products, including WhatsApp and Instagram, but it has been criticized on several fronts, from failing to protect users' privacy to not doing enough to halt the spread of disinformation.
Facebook, as I said, can truly decide what shows up in your newsfeed, what gets attention, what is put in the spotlight, and what is suppressed. And I think that's a big problem. It doesn't matter who you're friends with or who you like or the groups you're in, etc. They can filter stuff out through including certain ads. They can bury stuff in their algorithms. They can ban or censor or suspend accounts that may or may not go against the terms of service. Sometimes it's not so clear whether or not certain users go against terms of service, but find themselves banned or suspended anyway.
The accusations against the social media giant came amid a worldwide outage of the company's platforms. The social media services went down for almost 6 hours, impacting more than 3.5 billion users worldwide. The global outage and the revelations seriously harmed the media giant's status in the world as a reliable media platform.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Given that the Biden administration has continued the Trump administration policy of closing the traditional route of asking for asylum at ports of entry, asylum seekers took to the river, setting the stage for compelling video footage of large groups of immigrants turning themselves in at the border fence in Del Rio. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Michelle Garcia, reporter. This article is published under the heading U.S. border authorities failed to prepare for influx of migrants despite weeks of warnings. Stay tuned for more. By the time word spread that up to 15,000 mostly Haitian migrants had been detained under the international bridge in Del Rio, the small Texas border town had become occupied territory. A helicopter hovered over the Rio Grande. State troopers swarmed the river and were stationed every half mile along the surrounding roads. A tent city of military and law enforcement personnel had sprouted up on city-owned land on the south side of the border wall, near the makeshift camp where the Haitians slept. Inside the camp, in the dirt and the heat, pregnant women went into labor. 4 years ago, Republicans and Democrats linked arms with residents from both sides of the border to form a human chain across the bridge in show of unity. Yet in recent weeks, Del Rio has become a theater for a dramatic show of violence and force as mounted border patrol agents charged at Haitian migrants while twirling their reins like whips. Some 2,300 law enforcement officers said Mayor Bruno Lozano had been dispatched to Val Verde County, home to roughly 49,000 residents. one of the residents said, I don't feel it's in anybody's best interest to come in mass movement like that, adding that it creates security vulnerabilities elsewhere. If this is going to continue to be our response, it's not a good precedent. Outside a shelter operated by Val Verde Humanitarian Border Coalition, a local man carrying a holstered firearm said he was providing security to protect Haitians from hostile residents and outsiders. When Al Sharpton attempted to hold a media event near the border wall in solidarity with the Haitian migrants, he was shouted down by men who accused him of spreading racism. Volunteers in Del Rio collected donations and set out refreshments and snacks for state troopers. Overwhelmed was the word repeatedly used by federal, state, and local officials to describe Border Patrol agents who officials said were caught by surprise and unable to address the influx of Haitian migrants. But the arrival of Haitians was anticipated, and much of the chaos that ensued seemed preventable with basic planning and logistics. But in the scramble to contain the media crisis, the U.S. employed tactics that set off a cascade of repression and violence on both sides of the border. By allowing the situation to reach critical levels, federal officials created conditions that made a militarized crackdown seem inevitable, making criminals out of people, asserting that the right to seek asylum. Almost 30,000 migrants, mostly Haitians, were encountered in Del Rio after September 9th, said Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas in a briefing, and more than 12,000 will have their cases heard by an immigration judge. But more than 5,000 of those asylum seekers have been deported to Haiti just weeks after the U.S. extended and expanded temporary protected status of the country. As Mayorkas stated in May, Haiti is currently experiencing serious security concerns, social unrest, an increase in human rights abuses, crippling poverty, and lack of basic resources, which are exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. Wade McMullen, an attorney at RFK Human Rights, who traveled to Del Rio, said, "The arrival of vulnerable asylum seekers is not a crisis. The militarized response and lack of preparation, that's the crisis." Days after Border Patrol agents on horseback charged at Haitian migrants, Texas Governor Greg Abbott made full request of the mayor to authorize the state troopers to enter the city property to arrest the Haitian for criminal transgressing. A spokesperson for Abbott did not answer questions about the governor's request to conduct the arrest. After a massive deployment involving the Coast Guard, Texas National Guard, state troopers including air and marine support, and Customs and Border Protection, on September 24th, officials announced that Haitians were no longer under the bridge. After weeks of a growing encampment and worsening conditions, everyone had been cleared out in mere days. The aggressive response in Del Rio underscores an immigration system that prioritizes the spectacle of force over an investment in the construction of systems needed to process asylum seekers to conform to obligations dictated by international and U.S. law. Officials left little doubt that what the aggressive deployment was designed to send a message of deterrence to others who might also seek asylum. What we start doing to Haitians tends to spill over to everyone else, said Yael Schacher, an immigration historian and senior advocate with Refugees International. In 1980s, after the U.S. had experimented with imposing detention on Haitians, the policy was expanded to Central Americans fleeing U.S.-backed wars. County Judge Louis Owens, the top administrator of Val Verde County, described the state and federal law enforcement deployment as amazing. He said, "We want to lean on law enforcement to stop the flow." That said, there has to be a process to ask for asylum. Despite claims that border officials were caught off guard, signs of the impending arrival of a large number of asylum seekers were not hard to find. In the Del Rio area, the number of encounters with migrants had increased in 2021 over the prior year, with the numbers spiking over 1,000% by May, according to Customs and Border Protection data. In May, Lozano, a Democrat, met with congressional Republicans and appeared on Fox News complaining about illegals in Townsend, criticizing the Biden administration for a lack of response at the border. He said, unfortunately, at the time, it was only right-wing media groups like Fox News that were telling the story, adding that the policy needs to be reformed so ports of entry have to take them in legally and not be criminally charged. 2 months later, Border Patrol agents detained hundreds of people from various countries under the bridge in Del Rio. Meanwhile, a video that captured Mexican immigration officials brutalizing Haitian migrants who were headed north circulated online. The Spanish newspaper El País reported that Haitian claims for asylum in Mexico had reached a record high. By September, Mexico had received 19,000 petitions for asylum, higher than any other nationality, following a trend of Haitians transiting through Mexico that began 2 years ago. Even so, the United States officials repeatedly claimed that the arrival of Haitians on the border was a surprise. Given that the Biden administration has continued the Trump administration policy of closing the traditional route of asking for asylum at ports of entry, asylum seekers took to the river, setting the stage for compelling video footage of large groups of immigrants turning themselves in at the border fence in Del Rio, exciting viewers of Fox and Newsmax. In early August, George Ventura, a contributor to the right-wing Daily Caller, interviewed Del Rio residents about the crisis. Around this time, said Owens, the judge, county authorities were informed that caravans of some 25,000 people were expected to arrive on the border.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
Express our condolences on the occasion of the martyrdom of Ali ibn Musa Rida al-Murtada, al-Imam al-Barr al-Taqi, al-Radi al-Zaki, al-Hadi al-Mahdi, to all the believers, all the followers, lovers of the Ahlul Bayt, Salamullah alayhim ajma'in, and most of all to the Imam of our time. And we hope that these activities, commemorations, programs are accepted by those Imams and therefore accepted by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Imam al-Ridha's time and his leadership of the movement of the Ahlul Bayt, the movement of the true Islam, the movement of establishing the governance of Islam as it was at the time of the Prophet, as opposed to what was being framed as Islamic governance initially by the Umayyads and eventually by the Abbasids at the time of Imam al-Ridha salamullahi alayhi. While the movement grew stronger due to the efforts of the Ahlul Bayt, there were challenges and difficulties on the way. Imam al-Ridha's time is a very challenging time and a time with a lot of victories as well. And I believe one of the periods of imamah that is not studied well enough and discussed well enough in many circles, including circles of scholarship, is the period of the imamah of Imam Ali ibn Musa Ridha salamullahi alayhi, especially and more particularly the time that he spent, the last 2 years that he spent in Marwa, the whole process of taking Imam Ridha from Medina to Marwa. Prior to that, from the beginning of the Imam Ridha, the conditions were very particular to that time, what he had to deal with within the community of believers, within, in fact, the representatives of his father, Imam Musa al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, those representatives, some of them betrayed that Imam and betrayed Imam al-Ridha. And they announced that Imam al-Ridha is lying and Imam al-Kadhim has not been martyred in prison and in the dungeons of Harun. Rather, he's gone into occultation. They claim that the seventh Imam was the Mahdi, the one who will go into occultation, and created a great fitna that lasted for a number of years in a way where it was widespread. Some of the close companions of Imam al-Kadhim were confused about the imamah of the next imam and whether or not Imam al-Kadhim was in occultation or he had in fact passed on and he was martyred in the dungeons of Harun. And the fitna continued on until roughly around the minor occultation, where pretty much the movement of the Waqifis, those who opposed the imam of Imam al-Ridha, died out. And from that point onward, pretty much we don't have the fitna of the Waqifis. So the imam of Imam al-Ridha, his period of leadership and imamah is a very critical time in many ways, as of course all the periods of imamah of every single one of our imams is very critical for us to study and to learn and to see in those times how the imams maneuvered, how the imams behaved, and what their tactics were, what their strategies were in the face of the events that took place, so that we can make use of those tactics, those strategies, those guidances in the face of events that we can draw parallels to at our time compared to the time of those ma'sumin, salamullah alayhim ajma'in. The fitna of Ma'amun in taking Imam al-Ridha to Marwa is a very sinister and very cleverly crafted by a ruler that, compared to his predecessors and successors, is truly more gifted in terms of his intelligence. But like Muawiyah, they use that intelligence in the wrong way. He crafted his plan against the movement of the imams in a way that some of the close members of the Abbasid throne, some of those who raised the Ma'amun, who thought to be themselves to be very clever, they were outsmarted by Ma'amun in the process of bringing Imam al-Ridha in. It was a very clever plot to get rid of the movement of the Ahlul Bayt once and for all. I don't want to address what Ma'amun did in bringing, or what he was trying to do in bringing Imam al-Ridha to Marwa, or what Imam al-Ridha did against that plot, how he undid, how he went against, or he was able to defeat and outsmart the smartest ruler of the Abbasids. Inshallah, we get the chance to show our loyalty to that family and to the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Ya Mawla, صلى الله على يا غريب الغرباء. You know what I'm speaking of, Imam al-Ridha is a loving Imam. Our hearts are wanting to depart our bodies and come to your shrine. Ya Imam al-Ridha, Ruhi Fidak. This is what we feel when we go. But Ya Ghareeb al-Ghuraba, Imam al-Ridha was taken to a small village. Ma'mun had had enough. Now he wanted to end this. He was invited to the quarters of Ma'mun in that village. Imam al-Ridha had Abu Salt with him. It was evident that something was going to happen. Imam al-Ridha told Abu Salt, I'm going to enter this session. I will enter his quarters. If I come out and my head is covered in my cloak, know that something is wrong. Imam al-Ridha left the session. His head was covered with his cloak. They say the distance between his quarters and the quarters of the Imam was not very long, but between those two locations, the Imam had to sit down a number of times. He entered his quarters. He told Abu Salt, tell all the servants to leave, lock the doors. Abu Salt made sure everyone has left. He locked the gate of the courtyard. He turned around to go in. He sees a young boy there. He says, I just locked the door after making sure everyone's gone. How did you get in? He said, the Lord that brought me from Medina to this location can get me through that locked gate. Imam al-Jawad has come now. Imam al-Ridha is suffering from the pain of the poison. But Imam al-Jawad is there. He puts Imam al-Ridha's head on his lap. Imam al-Ridha takes his last breath while his head rests on Imam al-Jawad's lap. We say, Ya Imam al-Jawad, Ya Imam al-Ridha, I'm sure your time was difficult, but Imam al-Hussein didn't have his son to put his head on. In fact, the mal'oon who put his boots on the chest of Imam al-Hussein severed the head of Imam al-Hussein. ألا لعنة الله على القوم الظالمين وسيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون يا حسين.
اللهم صل على علي بن موسى الرضا المرتضى.
Yeah.
صلاة كثيرة تامة زاكية متواصلة متواترة مترادفة كأفضل ما صليت على أحد من أوليائك.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Russia has rejected as unfounded leaked information in the Pandora Papers accusing President Vladimir Putin's associates of amassing secret wealth, saying Moscow has no plans to conduct an investigation into the publication. We're prepared for you an article written jointly by Rowena Mason and Harry Davis. The piece is titled UK Labour Writes to Tory Chair Over Donations to 34 MPs by Firms Named in Pandora Papers. UK Labour Party has written to the Tory co-chair Oliver Dowden, raising concerns about donations to 34 Tory MPs by the companies backed by a Russian-born oil tycoon linked to an alleged corruption scandal. Annalise Dodds, the Labour Party chair, sent a letter to Oliver Dowden questioning why almost 1 in 10 Conservative MPs had taken money from firms linked to Viktor Fedotov, including Akind. Akind is currently seeking permission from the government to build a £1.2 billion electricity interconnector between France and the United Kingdom, which the business secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, is due to rule on within weeks. Britain's Labour Party claimed Viktor Fedotov's company has made huge donations to the Conservative Party and its politicians. Viktor Fedotov was revealed in the Pandora Papers to have secretly co-owned a company once accused of participating in a massive corruption scheme. Lawyers for Viktor Fedotov and Akind strongly denied all accusations of fraud and said accusations of corruption aimed at his firm were completely false. They said Fedotov did not personally donate to the Conservative Party. In her letter to Oliver Dowden, Annalisa Dodds claims, "I'm sure you will have been as shocked as I was by the Pandora Papers leaks over recent days and the extent of the offshore links and alleged corruption that they revealed." She said, "Particularly concerning was a revelation that 34 Conservative MPs, almost 1 in 10 of your parliamentary party, received £700,000 from Akind and another firm backed by Viktor Fedotov." In a series of questions, Annalisa Dodds asked, "Why did the 34 Conservative MPs do with the money they received from Mr. Fedotov's companies? Can you be certain there is no link to the pursuit of Akin's business interests?" Annalisa Dodds also called on Oliver Dowden to publish the list of all those who sit on donor groups paying £50,000 to £250,000 a year for different levels of access to the Prime Minister and his cabinet. She added, "This trend of secretive cash for access is deeply worrying, both for the sake of our democracy and for our national security. Why can't you level with the public and tell us just what it is that the people get for handing over huge sums of money to your party?" Akin's £1.2 billion project has already been mired in controversy amid local opposition and complaints over the company's donations to and links with the Conservative Party. Alexander Tomerko, who is a friend of the Prime Minister Boris Johnson and a co-owner of Akind, has together with the company donated £1.1 million to the Conservatives. There is no suggestion that Alexander Tomerko had any knowledge of the possible origins of Viktor Fedotov's wealth. Three Conservative ministers have already had to recuse themselves from the decision-making process over the Akind undersea cable because of their links to the company. The Fedotov-backed companies who allegedly donated to the 34 Tory MPs, including both Akind and a related firm, Offshore Group Newcastle, or OGN. Lawyers for Akin said Viktor Fedotov did not personally donate to the Tories. They also said the tycoon had no influence over donations made by Akin, which he does not manage, and has never had any interest in British politics. Akin's development between Portsmouth and Normandy is considered a nationally significant infrastructure project by government UK officials. It is opposed by Penny Mordaunt, a government minister and Portsmouth North MP, who has told the Portsmouth News that the project is a disaster for our city, for our national resilience and our national security. Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng, who will take the decision based on official advice, declined to comment on the Pandora Papers disclosures about Viktor Fedotov's business activities and the apparent source of wealth. According to the Pandora Papers revelations, a company Viktor Fedotov secretly co-owned, Venist, was accused of siphoning funds from the Russian state pipeline monopoly, Transneft, in the early 2000s. Leaked documents in the Pandora Papers claim he made at least $98 million from an offshore financial structure that appears to have funneled profits from Venist via multiple tax havens. Akin's lawyers said the allegations came from a wholly unreliable report and described the accusations as completely false. But one senior Conservative MP told The Guardian there were serious national security concerns about allowing the Akin project to proceed. Stephen Morgan, a Labour MP opposing the interconnector proposal, said he had raised concerns over alleged Akin cronyism and said ministers should stop their dither and delay and must immediately stop the project. A spokesperson for the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy said the decision over Akin's cable could be made solely by Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng. They added, no decision has yet been made. A Conservative Party spokesperson said government policy is in no way influenced by the donations the party receives. They are entirely separate. We are motivated by the priorities of the British public acting in the national interest. She added, the Conservative Party is funded by membership, fundraising and donations. Donations to the Conservative Party are properly and transparently declared to the Electoral Commission, openly published by them and comply fully with the law. She noted, fundraising is a legitimate part of the democratic process. The alternative is more taxpayer funding of political campaigning, which would mean less money for frontline services like schools, police, and hospitals. Meanwhile, Russia has rejected an unfounded leaked information in the Pandora Papers accusing President Vladimir Putin's associates of amassing secret wealth, saying Moscow has no plans to conduct an investigation into the publication of the Pandora Papers. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said on Monday, this is just a set of largely unsubstantiated claims, adding that it is not clear how this information can be trusted. Dmitry Peskov went on to say that Russia has seen no evidence in the massive data leak of hidden wealth among Vladimir Putin's entourage, despite allegations to the contrary from news organizations. Dmitry Peskov said, we didn't see anything on hidden wealth within Putin's inner circle, stressing that Moscow sees no reason to make checks on the data because it sees the leaked files as unfounded statements unless something it considers reliable is revealed. Dmitry Peskov said, "For now, it is just not clear what this information is and what it is about." He added, "If there are serious publications that are based on something concrete and refer to something specific, then we will read them with interest." The Pandora Papers earlier revealed that some American states, namely South Dakota and Nevada, have become perfect places to hide billions of dollars in wealth linked to people previously accused of financial crimes. The publication suggests that the United States has emerged as a leading tax haven thanks to local legislation allegedly drafted by the trust industry, which protects trust customers in the United States and abroad.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Ridha in the speeches of the leader. The 7th of September 2014. The beginning of the imamate of the 8th Imam, God's greetings be upon him, coincided with the dictatorial rule of Harun al-Rashid. This happened after the martyrdom of Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam in prison. Anyone who showed the slightest disobedience towards the wishes of the ruling system faced unrelenting pressures. It was in such circumstances that the 8th Imam alayhi salam was appointed to imamate. There is a narration which says, one of the followers of the Imams alayhi salam said, "This young person, the son of Musa ibn Ja'far, has accepted an important responsibility." This narration mentions blood trickles from Harun's sword. It was in such harrowing circumstances that Imam Ridha alayhi salam became an imam. in such difficult circumstances, this great personality managed to develop, among the Muslim society of those days, the bright line of the Holy Prophet's sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam's tradition and Quranic Islamic teachings. He managed to help hearts become closer to the school of the Holy Prophet and his household. Then it was Ma'mun's turn, and the story of his attempt to bring that great personality from Medina to Marv and to Khorasan. At that time, Marv was the capital of the Abbasid rule. They had changed the capital from Baghdad to Marv. Later on, they made Baghdad the capital city again. Baghdad was the center of Abbasid policy. The motivation behind the decision of Ma'mun and his ruling system to transfer the 8th Imam alayhi salam to Marv requires a long discussion. Ma'mun had made a calculation which was purely political. His policy was to strengthen the bases of his power and to weaken the movement of the Holy Prophet's household, God's greetings be upon all of them, and what they wanted to do. In the face of Ma'mun's political and shrewd move, the 8th Imam alayhi salam drew up and implemented a divinely intelligent plan. This plan not only foiled the plot and requests of the ruling system, but it also led to the development of Quranic teachings and ideas and thoughts of the Holy Prophet's household throughout the world of Islam. With a great movement, with a reliance on Allah the Exalted, with divine wisdom and acumen, and with an efficient and wilayi outlook, the 8th Imam, God's greetings be upon him, managed to foil this hostile plot of a dictatorial and oppressive ruling system. He used it to the advantage of the truth. This is an outstanding chapter of the history of the Imams. Alayhim as-salam.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.